This Week in Retronauts, an hour of brooding. Hi, everyone. Welcome to this thrilling episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this week we are bringing a topic to you by patron request. Thanks, Jeff Vlasic. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. I assume it's like the pickles. Yes, by supporting Retronauts through Patreon at the, it's like the Ultra 64 tier. He got to pick a topic, and he said, "Hey, Retronauts, will you talk about the games of Broderbund?" And then I looked it up and it turns out it's Bruderbund. So now we know we can put that aside us and we'll pronounce it however we end up pronouncing it, because I think the company always just went by Broderbund or Broderbund or something. Broderbund. Anyway.
They just write it funny.
Yes.
Which is not even the original spelling.
But right. Okay. We can talk about all of that. But in this moment, why don't you guys introduce yourselves? Let's start at the far end.
Oh, mixing
do
it up.
Do it different.
All right. So I'm Ben Elgin.
And you're here because...
And I'm here because I'm old and played a lot of old games. And some of those old games are by Broderbund.
That's right. That's correct. And also...
Ben Jedwards.
And you're here because...
I have also played many Broderbund games.
Oh, I thought you were going to say because Broderbund. You were just like showed up on the doorstep and were like, "Hey, what's up?"
Yeah, I said, "I need work.
Give me gin."
Please.
May I have more gin?
We haven't even broken out the gym yet.
Have we done the Oliver Twist?
Yeah, we did. We did the Pip.
It does sound familiar.
No, that's Great Expectations. Please, Pip.
Oh, wow.
And bring me some gin.
We're sober now. Just imagine how this is going to get after the break. Okay. So anyway, yes, Bruderbund is a company that still exists in some sort of permutation, but not really.
The brand exists.
Yes, the brand exists. The company was destroyed through a merger, because that's what happens when people merge. They are destroyed. And such is the way of video game history. People do great things for 15, 20 years and then are shattered irrevocably by corporations and capitalism. Good times. But we're going to talk about what happened before capitalism stepped in and shattered the band of brothers. And that is where we're going with Bruderbund. Before we get started, what experience do you guys have with Bruderbund games?
Man, so probably the earliest was a bunch of their Apple II output, some of which we talked about on the Apple II episode, because they had...
We will definitely be retracing some familiar territory here, but
absolutely.
This is by request by God, and we are going to live up to that expectation.
Yeah, no, and they're worth talking about more than once, probably. But so they had a lot of Apple II output in their early years, and a lot of that stuff ended up in schools. So I think that's probably where a lot of people ran into them first, is a lot of their games and some of their educational stuff and some of their utilities would be in schools in the 80s. So that's where you'd see them first.
Benj?
It's amazing how broad Broderbund marketing, you know, the categories they reached with their product as a publisher, from desktop applications to PC games to even NES publishing over the years. So I have experience with all of that. And I don't know if we shouldn't talk about specifics right now, because we're going to talk about each one of these.
We can talk a little bit about specifics. There's nothing wrong with that.
Like, I remember Load Runner, Speedlunker, the Midnight Magic even. I don't know if we're going to talk about that, but I saw that.
You can definitely talk about it. I don't know anything about it, but please.
It's a pinball game.
Okay.
Yeah.
We will definitely get there.
Not that great right now, but by today's standards, but it was exciting back then. And, you know, the print shop was a really big thing for them. That sort of shaped my childhood educational experiences and soccer teams, that coaches would use that to make calendars and teachers would print giant banners out on tractor feed paper.
Yeah, definitely lots of that.
I think some of the highlight ones that stick out in my memory that we'll get to, but that I really remember for a long one are Karateka. That was definitely a really big one. And then Carmen Sandiego and some of their Mac stuff too. Shuffle Puck, which we talked about in our Mac episodes. That was great.
When you look back, like Bruderbund was really just this, I feel like, an omnipresent force in gaming and even computing in general in the 80s and early 90s. Like, I didn't own a computer until sometime in the 90s, but I would still, like, what encounters I did have with computers, I feel like Bruderbund was always there. That logo with the three crowns, like, that is, I see, you know, doing research for this episode, looking through images and screenshots and stuff, and anytime I see, you know, that triple crown image reproduced in low resolution, like CGA graphics or whatever, I'm just like, it just takes you back. It does. Yeah. It really just, like, it throws me way back in time.
You'd see it on a shelf at Babbage's or software, et cetera. They'd be all over the place there.
Yeah. My student lab, computer lab in like fifth, sixth grade. So mid-80s, it was mostly, I've talked about this before, TI-99/4As, because that's what everyone had around there. And when I was in sixth grade, they were replaced with Macintoshes, which were clearly like a huge step forward. But there was always the one Apple II computer on the teacher's desk that I don't know what she used it for exactly. But
grades, maybe.
But the thing is, you know, like, I would volunteer to help out in the lab and, you know, clean up and everything. And then when I was done, she would let me play Load Runner on that computer. And that's what I wanted to play. Like, she had other stuff like Choplifter, which is also a Bruderbund game, and, you know, like Maze Chase type games. But I always wanted to play Load Runner on that one game, on that one computer, the disused Apple II that was the teacher's computer and the students never got to use. So, like, to me, it made the whole thing very special. Like, there is still this kind of aura around Load Runner for me, because it was inaccessible, and it was a special privilege to be able to play that game. And one of the first games I bought for NES when I got an NES a few years later was Load Runner, which was ported by Hudson and was pretty different in feel from the Apple II game, but still, like, recognizably that same game. So it was very satisfying to have the ability to play that game at home.
It's funny that you said that, because about the Apple II and Load Runner, because about 10 years ago, this guy from Virginia drove down to my house and, you know, he contacted me through my blog, Vintage Computing, and he had said he had some computers for me, and he dropped off essentially like an entire elementary school's worth of Apple II stuff, several computers and systems and accessories and like 10 boxes of disks. You know, there's a lot of MEC stuff, M-E-C-C, you know, the Oregon Trail people.
Yep.
And, but there's also, you know, there's people, there are grading things. There was actual grades from kids in the 80s and discs and stuff. But then there's a copy of Load Runner. I'm not even joking. That game was a
multi-million seller. It was huge. It was a smash hit. Yeah. I think that wasn't their biggest seller. Their biggest seller was Print Shop and then Myst. Mm-hmm. But definitely.
Carmen Sandiego, maybe?
It was up there. But I think those three games were like the big ones.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, once Load Runner started getting ported to consoles.
I didn't know they published Myst. I didn't even think about that.
They did. Yep. Yeah. I mean, Bruderbund was a pretty big force all the way into the 90s.
And they published some of my favorite NES games, like Legacy of the Wizard and...
That's right.
Mashao, Deadly Towers.
That's right. Deadly Towers. Yeah. Don't go into a reverie, though.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Don't look out the window.
I see him.
So, Bruderbund, the history of, if you go back a few months, I guess to last summer, I recorded an episode with David Craddock, the author of a book called Breakout, How Apple II Jumpstarted the PC revolution or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Anyway, David has two chapters in that book, which is specifically about the Apple II, but it really gets into the history of Bruderbund and where the company came from. And it has a lot of, first person sources. Like he actually went and talked to the people who founded the company. It's the best and most insightful history of Bruderbund I've ever seen. And it's definitely worth reading. So if you haven't checked that out, if you somehow didn't hear that episode of Retronauts and think I need to go buy this book, well, please go check it out because it's really good.
It is good.
I can corroborate. I read those chapters last night and this morning and they were good.
But basically, Bruderbund was founded around 1980 by two brothers and one sister, which makes the name of the company a little bit of a lie because Bruderbund is, I think, Danish for band of brothers. Mm-hmm. So it was two brothers and one sister. There was going to be three brothers, but the third one was like, computers, I don't really care. And the sister was like, actually I do. So it's more like band of siblings, but I guess that doesn't, read as well.
Sibley Bond.
Yeah, exactly. So they put together this company, and as with so many things in the history of computing, vintage computing, they started out very small, very shoestring, kind of a, scraping by desperately for a few years until they finally hit it big. And once they hit it big, then they were giants. Like they became one of the biggest publishers of computer software. They dabbled in, video game publishing. They licensed their games out. And, not only did they have huge hits in the 80s, but again, with Myst, they had the biggest game of the 90s until Sims came along in 2000. So yeah, Bruderbund was a big, big deal. Like I said, they were very omnipresent. And we were talking before the show about the name Bruderbund. It does mean band of brothers, but it has kind of a little bit of an uncomfortable origin to it. Benj, do you want to talk about that? Because it seemed to definitely stick with you.
Yeah, I just read, I got this information from Craddock's book, and I briefly read it about, it was the name of a white supremacist group in South Africa.
Yeah,
a pro-African
white nationalist group. Yeah.
White nationalists, yeah. And that's all I know. I don't know why. I don't remember why they picked the name. And
well,
why
the way it got in is because it was one of the group names in the 4X game that one of the brothers was writing, the Galactic, Empire. There was this trading federation that he gave this name just as kind of a... And they're being ominous almost worked, I think, as part of, because it was one of the rival factions in the game. And then, he just liked the name.
It has a good sound to it. I mean, the meaning
the
of it is
to
good.
Brothers, yeah.
Band of Brothers. That was a big hit on HBO.
Did they have any connection to South Africa, these brothers?
No, they actually had a connection to Sweden. So very far away from South Africa.
Mm, yeah.
The opposite end of that hemisphere.
How did they even know about the South African group?
I think they. I don't actually know that.
I've just been looking for interesting names for the game.
I don't think it really occurred to them this might be distasteful until people from South Africa, the game started making their way down there and people in South Africa were like, really guys, did you actually do that? But they spelled the name a little different in the South African name. The first vowel is a diphthong.
It's an O-E.
Whereas this is an O with a slash through it. And it's actually, even though they are closely connected to Sweden, and one of the brothers, I think Gary Carlston, was the coach for a Swedish basketball girls team, which sounds like a pretty good gig. They actually ended up going with a Danish name. So it's just a big mess of international references that really has nothing to do with the company itself, but it is an unusual origin for the name, and the sort of cultural ramifications have nothing to do with the software they created, which was great. Like their games and their software, they said in Craddock's book, I think Doug Carlston, the brother who really started the company up, I think it was him who said they were looking for good ideas. They were looking for things that no one else had brought to the market, where they saw an opportunity, a niche they could fill. So they would take, demos and submissions from people, these amateur coders, and they might have been broken and even unfinished or just a raw idea. But if they saw a spark of innovation and creativity in that demo, then they didn't really care about the polish or about the technical finesse because they brought on their own coders. They had programmers in-house who could, you know, work with that designer and help them realize their vision. And that's a great, great corporate mission. I mean, obviously they were there to make money and they made lots of money, but you know, the driving business model there was like, let's bring something new to the market. Let's give people with great ideas an opportunity to realize their dreams. I love that. And I really feel like one of the reasons Brutterbund, whatever games resonate with people so much is because, you know, there is that driving instinct behind them. Like the idea of, you know, giving people a new experience and really fostering creativity and like that's what a publisher should be. A publisher should be the people who come in and say, we have the resources, we have the money, you have the ideas, let's get together and make this thing happen. And I don't know that methodology really exists that much in today's games industry, but you know, things were more freewheeling back then. The industry, really, computers and video games were much smaller than they are now.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you said that because the whole game industry was sort of like an indie industry back then, mm-hmm. like the indies are now.
Yeah, that you basically had Atari working for Warner, and that was it. Everyone else was dinky.
Yeah, they didn't have these corporate publishing giants like EA squeezing the life out of everything.
No, EA back then was like Brutterbund.
Yeah,
they were like, we're electronic artists. We create great things. We're visionaries. Yeah,
totally different back then. But yeah, I'm just saying it wasn't like the EA of today.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, they really embraced this model of just going out and finding people. If you look at the history, only like some of their very early games were actually originated in-house. Everything else was someone, you know, somebody was submitting something and they latched onto it. And so you have all these like really interesting people coming through, like, you know, Mechner getting a start there. And
is it Mechner or Mechner?
I thought maybe you knew. Mechner, but
it's probably Mechner.
I honestly don't know. I've never met the man, and I've never heard anyone professional who knows him say his name.
And Will Wright. So yeah, Mechner and Will Wright and all these interesting people who went on to do great things were just some of the people basically picked up off the street, more or less, by mm-hmm. Brutterbund.
You think Will Wright was sitting on the street writing games?
Well, probably.
You know,
yeah,
maybe.
Just like, I mean, you know, we'll code for food.
For gin.
Yeah.
A lot of these people were essentially at the hobbyist level at that time. You know, it was like kind of what became the shareware scene later on, where mm-hmm. you just code something up and show it around to people. And, you know, maybe you could sell a few copies and that'd be great. And, you know, some of these people reading the history, they would just literally like walk into a computer store and say, I wrote a game. Do you want to sell it?
Right.
That's
what Brutterbund did for a while.
Right. Right. Well, Brutterbund walked in trying to push what they were publishing. But also original artists would come in and be like, how do I sell my game? And, you know, in some lucky instances, someone passed them on to a place like Brutterbund that could actually had the resources to, you know, shepherd them to completion and get them out the door and in stores.
A lot of the history we have here is taken again from Breakout by David Craddock. And so I don't want to just like rehash everything in that book, but there is some great info there. Like from the very beginning, Brutterbund was like their success and their fortunes were tied to a Japanese game publisher, which, you know, that was something that would become very prevalent in the mid 80s, you know, especially once Nintendo made a foothold in the US. But at the time, that was still something kind of new. Like you had arcade importers like Midway and Stern and Gremlin bringing over Japanese made games, and you had Nintendo kind of establishing itself as its own, you know, entity in the US. But the collaboration between American and Japanese publishers didn't really happen that much. But it was basically a Japanese corporation or a small company called StarCraft, no relation, that kind of propelled Brutterbund into success. Because in the beginning, Brutterbund was making games for TRS-80, which, you know, that had its fans. It was a very affordable system. It was also a very poorly made system to keep costs down with low quality parts, hence the nickname Trash 80. But they found that there just wasn't much success to be had by peddling software releases for TRS-80. But they went to a convention, a trade show in San Francisco, and their booth was next to a Japanese company called StarCraft, who had Apple IIs, and they had brought an Apple II along. And StarCraft was making, I believe, like Galaxian clones and things like that. Like
real time strategy games?
No, not real time strategy games. That was Brüderbund, and those were not very exciting to look at.
Very arcadey stuff, which was kind of unusual still.
Yeah, it's funny because Brüderbund made the first 4X game in Galactic Empires.
Which they were running.
So then they teamed up with StarCraft, which is kind of like the king of that genre. So there is kind of like this funny little bit of connection there that's totally incidental. But basically they said, why don't you guys show your Apple II games that are really cool on the computers at our booth, and that'll draw people over. And then, you know, people started taking interest in the flashy Apple II games that were playing, and then they would see, you know, Galactic Empire and that sort of thing. And so Brüderbund began distributing StarCraft games in America, and then they started making their own Apple II games. And from there, they just kind of changed their business model, and they really took off when they started releasing games like Choplifter and Load Runner and so forth.
Do you know the names of any of those StarCraft games for the Apple II? I don't know.
Let's see.
I'm wondering if I'm familiar
with them. I don't think I wrote it down.
There's Alien Rain.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically Galaxian.
Which was a Galaxian clone, and they changed the name to be slightly
Alien
less.
Rain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You like, know, because they're raining bullets on you.
Yeah.
It's like chocolate rain, but with aliens.
I may have had that for my Apple II.
Yeah, and it was, and it, like, this was kind of the niche that this Japanese company, StarCraft, had fallen into, is like really pushing the boundaries of getting arcade looking stuff working on an Apple II. Because, you know, the original Apple II was not, you know, kind of,
it was not
was
made
not
for
known
that,
for action oriented
like,
stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about how Steve Wozniak was like, I want to be able to play Breakout on this computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
and
that stuff
so,
was in there.
So there was like the capabilities for generating graphics and fast action were there. But no one really kind of locked it down until
it wasn't
early
easy.
80s.
You had to really learn the hardware to figure out how to squeeze this stuff out of it.
Right. And I think this really gets to kind of, you know, something that was advantageous for Brüderbund, you know, like not hooking up, but making this connection with a Japanese developer or publisher, because there is this great element of discipline in Japanese game design and development from that era, where you would really see them push the technical limits of a system. And you saw that, you know, with American and European publishers too. But it was always a little bit of a different vibe that you got from Japanese programmers and developers. Yeah.
Well, so, they had a different culture, obviously.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Changed. They had different mythology and stuff, different expectations.
I don't know about mythology, but definitely like a different, just a different system. And so they would push computers in a different way than, like, you know, people who would do European demo scene coding. So I think that really helped Brüderbund establish themselves here with something that was unique. And like no one else really had that on Apple II. So as this computer platform started to explode, they were there and they had the advantage of this great licensing deal with StarCraft. It was good for StarCraft because they were able to sell their games to thousands and thousands of Americans that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. It was great for Brüderbund because they had a really good licensing deal and they were making money off of it, and it made them look very attractive. And so then people started coming to Brüderbund and saying, you know, again, like, we have these ideas, can you help us? And they would pick, you know, cherry pick and say, this is a great idea, let's go with it. Basically the origin story of Brüderbund. But why don't we talk about I don't know that there's that much more to talk about in terms of its history, aside from the fact that they made games for a long time. And then in the late 80s or late 90s, the Learning Company came along. Mm-hmm. And the Learning Company was basically, I think that was who it was.
There was actually some shell company that owned the Learning Company, I think, that ultimately acquired them and kind of munged all the properties around between the two of them.
Well, they were purchased by the Learning Company, which was, I think they were owned by a bigger conglomerate. But it was basically one of those cases of consolidation where companies were going around saying, who has hot properties? Let's acquire them, get rid of the workforce, and, you know, parcel out the intellectual properties. So obviously, you know, with the Myst franchise under their belt, Bruderbund was very attractive because in 1998, they had just come out with Riven. And it was a big deal. Myst 3 Exile was on the way out. Like, it was very exciting. It was going to sell really well. So yeah, that would make them a very attractive target. So the learning company or whoever owned them came in and said, great. And then I think laid off like half of the Bruderbund workforce.
Yeah.
And then like a year or two later, they sold off the gaming properties to Ubisoft, which is why Ubisoft... I think they did great things with like Prince of Persia, Sands of Time.
The
Myst games that they put together were actually really good. The final two games in the series.
Some of the franchises did quite well.
Like, it wasn't bad that Ubisoft got a hold of these games, but it does really suck for everyone who worked at Bruderbund and lost their jobs as a result. And then their desktop properties were given to Riverdeep, who I don't know if they still hold those properties or if it's some other company, but they keep Bruderbund's name alive as an imprint for, I want to say Calendar Creator.
Yeah.
Which is, which debuted in 1995 and is up to version 12 something now at this point.
Wow.
And is still being sold under the Bruderbund label.
Yeah, and I think there's some other edutainment and utility software that still uses the brand. Pretty far divorced from the original context at this point.
So let's look back at Bruderbund's history of making applications, not software and video, not video games and not computer games. We'll talk about their applications first, because they did kind of, they got their start making video games, but I feel like they made their first big impression on me. I talked about Lode Runner, but before that there was the print shop. Like, everyone who was in elementary school in the 80s and maybe into the 90s is like, oh yes, the print shop. Yep. I know the print shop. It was everywhere. Everyone who had a computer had the print shop. I don't know. Looking over their applications, like even the ones that aren't video games, they're still very closely tied to video games. Their first big software creation, non-game software creation, was called Arcade Machine, and it was basically Super Mario Maker before there was Super Mario Maker. It was I've never used it myself, but it was apparently pretty big, pretty successful. It came out right around the same time as Bill Budge's pinball construction set. Mm-hmm. And it was the same sort of idea. Like, here are the tools, you can make simple video games. And maybe because they had, you know, kind of gotten their start with licensing Alien Rain from StarCraft, they kind of made this software default to creating Galaxian style shooters.
Yeah. I've played some games made with that. Like on the Atari 800 or something that says made with Arcade Game Creator. And I think they're all shooter games, the ones I played, like Galaxian kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I did look at a gallery of games that had been made with Arcade Machine. And you could do something other than shooters, but I definitely think that was sort of the default. Like, you can do things with Super Mario Maker that aren't just, you know, run and jump to the end of the level platformers, but you kind of have to work at it. Mm-hmm. So I think it was the same sort of thing. But it was highly acclaimed at the time. Like, reading through old reviews of it, people were like, this is genius. Like, this
innovative.
This and pinball construction set.
Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, you are the video game creator. You can get infinite replay out of this because you're making the games yourself.
Yeah. I mean, for back then, even just being able to, you know, change it to your own graphics and like change the behavior of things, even if it was hard to do a lot with the underlying game structure, I mean, that was huge.
Yeah, I mean, back then you had to like learn BASIC or ProDOS in order to program,
at least,
and do all these like calls and, you know, if and conditional statements. And I'm terrible at programming, so it was always just beyond me.
Well, and even beyond that, I mean, things like if you're starting from scratch, things like using the tiny amounts of memory that were in all these machines without immediately running out was, you know, serious low level stuff.
Yeah,
that
I think
no one was going to want to deal with.
I think as long as there are video games, there will be a market for applications and tools that allow you to create video games, even if they're rudimentary, like something like WarioWare DIY, where you're making games that are like 5 seconds long. Like, that's still really cool, and you know, you learn a lot in the process. Like, what are the processes here? And so this was a great step.
This Arcade Maker, it's sort of like one of the first game engines. It's a lot like, you know, making the tools like Unreal Engine that people could use to develop games.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely more simplistic than that. Yeah, but like it's a move in that direction.
Yeah. And,
you know, you would see like a big part of Doom's popularity in the 90s was that it was so easy to modify by design. Like it said, we need to make this game, you know, this platform for people to customize and create their own levels and their own graphics. And that kind of open platform, even something like Minecraft is huge because it does allow that element of creativity, of personal customization.
Well, and we'll also hit this again when we talk about the games because LoadRunner. One of the first things to come with an editor.
Yep.
So.
And a lot of their applications are really they're very much designed around creativity and self-expression. 1984, Bruderbund released a program called Dazzle Draw, which was basically like a very affordable Apple II-based take on Mac Paint, the extremely successful. Was Mac Paint built into the Macintosh? No, I think you had to buy it separately.
It depended on what era you were buying in. I think sometimes it was bundled and sometimes it wasn't. But it was extremely popular.
Right. Well, Mac Paint was a big deal because it was a paint app that took advantage of the Macintosh and let you use a mouse to paint with.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, bringing that back onto the Apple II, you're getting a different kind of platform. But taking that, the ideas and the elements and even like the menu-driven elements of Mac Paint and saying, now you can have that on Apple II also, like that was very compelling. And doing some research about it.
Believe it or not, I was just using Dazzle Draw yesterday.
Were you?
Apple IIc, yeah. I use it as a demonstration in my garage with the computers in it because it's a really neat, vivid way to use the Apple IIc because it utilizes the Apple IIc's extended color mode that a lot of programs don't take advantage of.
So interesting.
And it's got a great interface. It's really smoothly well written and stable.
Well, why don't you? I'm sitting here talking about like I've researched this. You've used it, so
yeah.
Don't let me jabber jaw.
And
for
I think
a while.
Mac Paint did ship with the Macintosh at first. It was with Mac Write and Mac Paint and stuff. But yeah, in 1984, when Apple launched the Macintosh, they also launched the Apple IIc, and they launched it with a mouse too to tie into their mouse related stuff. And they had a program called Mouse Paint that was like Mac Paint, but for the Apple II. And so Dazzle Draw is definitely many steps up. It has better tools like a spray paint tool that's really nice. It's got all kinds of zooming tools and just the colors are amazing and vivid on that. And it runs this like double high res mode on the Apple IIc that has all these colors. And I mean, it works really well. I love to play around with it and I let my kids draw on it. And I wouldn't be surprised if people used it to develop games as a art editor because it was really high quality.
Graphics to import into an arcade machine.
Yeah, nice.
Or anything, like another game on the Apple II.
Yeah, and another compelling thing about Arcade Machine is that it was like $50, whereas other paint applications were $100, $200. They were a lot more expensive. This was, you know, there was no standardization for software pricing back then. So kind of coming in with a very versatile, capable application that cost half as much as any other application on the market, like that's a very compelling set of features. So I can see where that was very successful for
you. Yeah, applications tended to be way up there, like you know, especially compared to games of the same era. It's like I'm pretty sure I was reading Alien Rain was like $20, the StarCraft game. But yeah, applications would range way up from there.
Right. Same time in 1984, they also released the Print Shop, which was ubiquitous in the 80s. Like every computer lab had the Print Shop. Most people who owned a computer at home had the Print Shop. It allowed you to make cards, banners, posters, flyers. It was basically maybe the original desktop publishing program, and obviously not a patch on something like InDesign or Quark Express, But I mean, you know, for the capabilities of the computer at the era, back when the Macintosh, which was the desktop publishing machine, was first appearing on the market, here was a program that for a very inexpensive price, it was probably like $100 or so, would allow you to do a lot of the things that Apple was promising you could do on Macintosh.
And on an Apple II, which right, millions much, of schools, right. well, millions, and it's, thousands of schools had already, you know.
And it's the capabilities Apple not II. Just of the machine, but also of the printer. Because, you know, you'd have all this detailed Macintosh high-density pixel graphics, but most people just had a little dot matrix printer. And the resolution on that is really low. And that's what Print Shop was specifically targeted at, was this combination of the Apple II and a dot matrix printer to make, and it came with stuff that would look good on it. And so you had layouts that were designed to come out mm-hmm. at the resolution of those printers that, right. that again, every school had.
Yeah, and I remember like sitting there for 5 minutes while you print out a banner that yeah. just kept going. I think you said on the tractor feed paper, mm-hmm. like just keeps right. going and going.
Yeah, you've got this banner.
Yeah, the loud dot matrix running away at it.
But it's an advantage of that kind of printer is that you have that because the paper comes in a continuous feed.
Right, and it had all this clip art in it so you could like decorate mm-hmm. the banner. It wasn't just words. Like it allowed you to kind of spruce things up. It was a little bit of a creativity application, a little bit of a practical application, but it had so many uses.
I have a few stories about the print shop.
Yeah.
Which is, I found some old cards that my dad made with the print shop for me and my brother as kids for Halloween and stuff. It had the Halloween clip art, you know, and he'd print it out in a Christmas one. And I still have them. I've scanned them and put them on Vintage Computing as one of the retro scans over the years. And as I mentioned to Jeremy before this, that my soccer coach as a kid would use this for calendars. They had a calendar thing where you could put little icons on the calendar and, you know, for schedules, and the teachers would use it for calendars, and oh man, it was amazing. But one of the most interesting things about the print shop, I think, was about 10 years ago. Somebody contacted me, their father had passed away and they wanted some sort of really computer like, art or something to display at the funeral. And it was, she was trying to figure out what it was that they used to do to make these banners, you know, and it had to have Snoopy on it or something. And I figured out it was the print shop. And I think I made a banner for her to use, and she printed it out herself somehow. This is a long time ago, but that's the cultural impact of this program, that it was so, you know, it was associated with that, her father's identity somehow as a computer guy, and that, you know, at his own funeral, they wanted a print shop banner there. So that's really something.
Yeah, that's awesome. It was just, you know, it was such a pervasive part of computing. And it's not video game-ish related, but mm-hmm. to me, it's all tied up to that era where everything on the computer was just cool, whether it was a video game or you were just farting around in an art program or making...
Or just,
you know,
farting.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't do a lot of that, but... But, you know, just making little things to hand out for your classmates or whatever, like mm-hmm. it was all fun and it was new and it was exciting. And the print shop really captured that.
For every occasion, there's the print shop.
Exactly.
Birthdays, exactly. Anniversaries, exactly. Weddings.
Bar mitzvahs, funerals.
Funerals, yeah. Classrooms.
One of the other interesting tidbits I came across looking at history for the print shop is that it was also apparently the subject of one of the industry's first look and feel lawsuits. So there's this company I don't really know anything about called Unison, who came to Rotorund wanting to do a DOS version of this. And for some reason, the deal fell through. But they just basically went ahead and did it anyways. And so then there was this lawsuit of, can you make software that basically looks exactly like someone else's software, but you tried to write it somewhere else and do the same thing? And so, you know, that became the basis of a whole lot of drama in the computer industry going forward.
Yeah, that happened a lot with
Apple
a lot of
Microsoft
things.
And
when people wanted to make a port and they didn't get permission,
right?
It ended
just
up
do it
else.
Anyways. Yeah.
Just like Commander Keen got started as
like
a Mario
Alien Rain,
which
was pretty much Galaxian.
There's a lot of this.
Yeah, Rotorbund definitely wasn't innocent of that themselves.
No.
But I can,
I mean,
you know,
no one
like
was.
Once you kind of have your hit, then all of a sudden you become a little protectionist of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's kind of the drawback. But yeah, we all become our worst enemies or whatever. But still, Print Shop was great, and it was it had kind of an offshoot a few years later called the Banner Shop, which, or Banner Mania.
Banner Mania, yeah.
Banner Mania, that's it. And that was pretty much like the banner element of the print shop blown up and made into itself. And I don't know, maybe that's actually how I remember someone printing out the tractor feed banners, but I thought you could do that with print shop.
You can do it on print shop.
It's just, you could do it better with Banner Mania. But the last sort of original kind of innovative piece of software I think that Ruderman put together was, where did my notes go?
Calendar?
Fantavision.
Or Fantavision.
Which is not the same as the Fantavision you know and love on PlayStation 2. It was a vector-based animation program that I had never heard of until I was researching this, but it sounds like something I would have loved as a kid.
Yeah,
like,
I never came across
it. You worked with vectors and like anchor points and stuff and sort of scripted how they would move together. And yeah, you couldn't do like rounded objects, but still like doing these kind of simple animations of figures or objects or things flying through the air, that would have been really cool. Like you could do your own simple primitive rendition of Money for Nothing. I don't know.
That's
extra simplified.
Yeah, but I've never
heard
really
of... cool. And it didn't take off like some of their other stuff did, so you just didn't find it.
Yeah, I've never heard of Fantavision, but it sounds cool.
Yeah, like I saw some demos that had been made in it, and it's very simplistic. But again, this was 1985.
Yeah.
So being able to do that on an Apple II in 1985, wow, that would have been crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I feel like I really missed out by not having a computer in the 80s. I mean, yes, obviously I did, but so kind of after Fantavision, I feel like Ruderbund's application output became sort of recursive. Like they weren't really doing much that was new and different. They had Banner Mania, they had Arcade Game Construction Kit, which was basically an upgrade to the arcade machine that was designed for Commodore 64. And I feel like their business model kind of shifted more and more towards C64 over the course of the 80s as that became sort of the big widespread mainstream consumer-facing computer platform. But I kind of feel like they got a second wind in the early 90s when they started moving into edutainment. You had things like The Playroom in 1991, which was kind of, you know, almost like a Scum adventure game, but instead of being an adventure game, it was more of a like click and point and, you know, look and see what's in this room and have little stories about it and that sort of thing. Like very simple, but with an educational value. And it basically was make a learning fun kind of thing. But at the time it was new and fresh. And I feel like it would have been a very good way to draw children into learning to read and learning to, you know, deal with things like shapes and colors and all that stuff with a fun computer interface. And then they started a series called Living Books, which were interactive storybooks, which, you know, that's a pretty well-worn idea at this point, but they were one of the first publishers to put that out there. And they licensed up some pretty big properties, including Dr. Seuss, the Berenstain Bears, that's AI, not EI. Yeah,
are you sure about that?
I'm positive. You're suffering the Mandela effect. And then finally,
Nelson Mandela.
Finally, the calendar creator in 1995, which was exactly what it says on the box, an application for creating calendars. And again, that is still sold in this day and age. You can go down to you don't even have to go to the store. You can buy it online. It's crazy.
Go down to your computer.
Do they still have software?
Go down to your internet store. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So that's still around. That's the sort of lasting legacy for Ruderbund.
So there'll always be a need to create a calendar, I guess.
I guess so. It's just a thing. And that was pretty much it. Like those were sort of their big learning and productivity applications. I feel like why people really love Ruderbund and the reason our patron sponsor probably wants us to talk about Ruderbund is to talk about video games. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and we will talk about video and computer games by Ruderbund, Broderbund, or Broderbund. Take your pick. back. And since we're back, I think it's time for That's Right, Listener Mail. All right, so I put out a call for people to send us cool stuff about Bruderbund, their memories and questions and comments and concerns and so on and so forth, and they delivered. So from Kyle Nickerson, these are probably mostly focused around video game aspects of the company's catalog, but I'm sure it ranges further afield. Let's find out. Kyle Nickerson, I just wanted to give a shout out to the Sega Master System version of Choplifter, which I consider to be the best version of the game. That one was probably developed by Sega, is my guess, because the arcade game was.
Yeah, it's probably
or at least published. Yeah. Controls are smooth and responsive. The game looks better than any other port I've seen, and the music and sound are both very enjoyable. From what I understand, this is actually a port of a Sega-developed arcade adaptation of the Bruderbund original. That could explain the difficulty, which seems to exponentially increase after the first level. I honestly can't bring myself to play when other versions... Most other versions to compare it, though, it just doesn't feel right to play another version when Sega nailed it.
Yes, we talked about that one on the Sega Arcade episode. Mm-hmm. It's a good.
I love obscure ports, or in this case, maybe not obscure, but just alternative ports.
Master System is like it's bordering obscurity.
I'd say alternative ports.
Yes.
Like, I have favorite versions of games on the 7800 that nobody plays.
From Joe Drilling, as someone who didn't own a computer until the mid-90s, most of my memories of Bruderbund are as a publisher of offbeat Japanese games on the NES. We didn't know that at the time, of course, but they brought us games from Compile, Falcom, and more. Mm-hmm. In fact, if nothing else, I'll always be grateful that they brought the Zelda shoot-em-up marriage, The Guardian Legend, to our shores. And yeah, that cover art has nothing to do with the game, but it looks badass. What's the panel's feeling on Bruderbund's NES output? Well, I think that is a question that demands its entire section. Let's get to that in a moment.
I love it.
We'll circle back.
We will.
From Kevin Boyer, I wanted to say thanks to Bruderbund for publishing The Battle of Olympus and The Guardian Legend here in the U.S. The first is a fairly new pickup for me, the second an old favorite, recently repurchased. I'm only sad that some of the purchase money didn't go to the publisher that brought the titles here. From Claybot Uno, among many cherished memories of the Big B are my fond recollections of playing Earhart on Apple II. I don't know that one. The game ran well, not the case for all software on my Apple II GS. It looked awesome with small detailed animations and artwork, physics that made sense, probably pushing the capabilities of Apple II, I suspect, and a sense of adventure and mystery and fluid arcade gameplay one didn't frequently find on Apple II games of that era. Watching videos of it now, it certainly doesn't look as good as I remember, which is always a hazard of retro gaming. But the open-ended exploration across a seemingly massive open sea map does in fact remind me of a rudimentary sort of Zelda the Wind Waker. A mysterious hero sailing across a vast sea solving puzzles and battling enemies. I had a ton of fun with this game. Any mention of Bruderbund would not be complete without also mentioning the almighty print shop. I shudder to think how many forests were felled by children printing 4-foot Matthew's Bedroom Stay Out banners or ridiculously low-res birthday cards for our moms. Ah, the fun of desktop publishing was upon us. And finally, a PC gaming question for Benj. Do you know where my copy of Zany Golf for Apple II GS got to? I've been looking everywhere.
Yeah, I have it.
Oh, see? Good thing he asked. I'll hook you
That's
guys up.
That's a great
after.
Game. Yeah. Was that wasn't published by Bert?
I don't think it was. Okay. I think that was just an unrelated question.
Yeah.
So from Mike Mariano, Bruderbund might hold the record for distributing, pound for pound, the most feelies with their software, all thanks to the New American Desk Encyclopedia packaged with Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego. Mm-hmm. The encyclopedia was a single volume paperback, but was still hundreds of pages of reference material with no obvious connection to a video game. Decades later, this encyclopedia still sits on a bookshelf in my parents' house, even if its days of temporal crime fighting are behind it. And I did pick up a copy of Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego for NES, complete with the giant-ass encyclopedia published by Konami in the U.S. Nice. I picked that up last year at Midwest Gaming Expo, and I had to carry it home in my suitcase, and that was stupid.
I remember seeing that sitting around, and I was impressed.
Sitting around here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Here.
Okay.
Retronauts headquarters.
Retronauts HQ.
Yeah.
In sunny Raleigh, North Carolina. From Zach Adams. My first brush with Bruderbund as a publisher was in late 1982 and early 83, when ads and reviews for Choplifter... Oh, he put the exclamation point at the end. That's very good. I admire that. Thank you, Zach Adams. And Loadrunner started showing up in Electronic Games and other less memorable magazines. I thought they looked exciting, but our Commodore 64 was not something we were allowed to game on. That's what the Atari was for. I pretty quickly discerned from reviews that Bruderbund, which I called Borderbound and somehow thought their logo was moose antlers or something. I can see that.
Awesome.
Made some of the best things on the shelves. A friend had an Apple II with most of their games, and I thought they were really cool, but a little advanced for six-year-old me. Still, when the 2600 was finally and truly dead for a while at retail, and the computer game prohibition lifted, we looked unsuccessfully for those in other games. When we got an NES in 1987, my brother and I sought out everything they made, and, aside from Spelunker, they didn't steer us wrong. Lode Runner, Battle of Olympus, and Guardian Legend were all things we rented endlessly until they made Christmas lists. And we were even briefly excited for the U-Force until it became apparent that even the Power Glove was better. I forgot that Bruderbund did the U-Force.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that.
All right, here we go with an application mail. Matthew Green says, Bruderbund's The Print Shop for Commodore 64 was a revelation for my family when I was a kid. We printed greeting cards for all occasions, and I loved cranking out signs. Banners used too much paper to print often, sadly. Funny how printing your own greeting cards was such a time and money saver back then. But later programs for Windows required special card paper, and of course, the modern era brought us DLC themes and ad-laden e-cards. Suddenly, those old basic black and white print shop cards look pretty good. And finally, from James Irish, my most frequent encounters with Bruderbund were the Carmen Sandiego games, which I played frequently in the sixth grade, and was one of the few highlights of a tough year for me, moving into a new town and adapting poorly to a new school. I eventually got Where in the USA for PC for my birthday from my grandmother the first year we had a computer, though she thought it was for my dad and accidentally gave me his Christmas gift, Lemmings, at first. And I played it so much, I memorized the clue to a degree where I could fly through the early cases fairly quickly, but still never caught Carmen herself. When the CD era arrived, my dad picked up Myst when it came out and was determined to beat the game. I tried it a couple of times and was utterly flummoxed by it and figured it was way too complex for me. I think it was too complex for him as well, since the hint book he got with the game did develop some creases in the spine eventually. But he did eventually beat it. So that is the collective memories that the Retronauts community shares for Bruderbund's games. And it sounds like they all kind of hit the big titles. But Bruderbund's PC and console software was actually quite a bit further ranging than that. It goes all the way back to 1980. And we kind of touched on this, but there's some really great like cornerstone type video games in this set of games. Did you guys ever play Galactic Empire by chance, or does that kind of predate you?
It rings a bell, but I did not have a TRS-80 I was a teenager.
Yeah, I'm old, but I was
when I was collecting.
I may be old, but I was 4 years old when that game came out, so it was a little bit beyond me. And yeah, we didn't have never had a TRS-80.
I think they did port the games to
they did port
Apple.
It. They did port it later.
Once they switched over to Apple.
I don't think I ever saw it running on the Apple IIs at school or anything. It was not really the sort of thing you could just sit down for a minute after you'd finished your work.
The original TRS-80 doesn't have bitmap graphics capabilities. No, so it just says text. Character graphics. So it was never appealing to me to even try to play games on that.
But, you know, this was a strategy game. Yeah, it was a simulation. Strategy. I mean, it was, like I said earlier, arguably the first 4X game, which is expand, exterminate, explore and...
Exploit,
yeah.
Yeah, exploit the resources.
I probably got those all out of order,
Totally out of order. Yeah. But
you know, that's pretty much the standard for, you know, StarCraft and games like that now.
Spread, mine, conquer,
exactly.
Kind of stuff. Yeah.
So it's a really kind of a landmark game. So actually, the Galactic Empire games were multiple parts. There was a saga, and Galactic Empire is the name of the saga. I don't know the individual titles.
I thought Galactic Empire was the 4X game in the Galactic Saga.
Oh, is that it?
I think that's what it says.
I don't know. I'm a little fuzzy on this one, I admit, because it's really kind of an early creation and not a genre that I know that well.
Yeah, and it was one of the few games written entirely by one of the founders of Bruderbund, one of the brothers.
Right.
And one of the
did we even
the
give their names? I don't think we did.
I said Doug and
Gary, but I didn't name their sister Kathy, and their last name was Carlston. I feel bad about that. Yes, Doug, Gary, and Kathy.
Yeah. And so I believe this was Doug's baby. Basically, is what he had started working on when he decided to get into trying to sell computer software.
Right. I don't think these are necessarily games that would hold up well that you'd want to play now, but I mean, they predate Mule. So
yeah,
Like, these are really, like, it's a sort of, wow, you know, like somewhere along the lines of a Kalabeth or something. Like,
they're
first in the genre.
There may have been a 4X game that predated this called Empire, which was a turn-based war game created around 1971 for mainframe computers. Wow. So that inspired Sid Meier. Sure,
there's always some sort of precursor, but that was not a commercial product that you could buy.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
So
not at the time anyway.
So in terms of computer facing games.
They may have been inspired by that, the brothers.
It could be. Although possible. From what it said in the Craddock book, they didn't have the academic computing background that most people do.
Yeah,
Doug Carlston was a lawyer in Chicago and was like, I hate the big city. So he moved out to Maine, and became a lawyer in a small town and basically kept getting ripped off by a bunch of rednecks. So I was like, I can't keep doing this as a business. So he just kind of got into computing because it seemed like an opportunity.
Doing it in his spare time.
Whereas, most people who, kind of established video game companies in the late 70s, early 80s, like they came from academic backgrounds, like the implementers for Zork who created Infocom. Mm-hmm. But
that's where the computers were. You had access to a mainframe when you were in an academic setting, and so you would mess around in your spare time.
Yeah, but Brüderbund was one of the first, I think, companies that really represented people from the outside of the computer community saying, there's money to be made here. There's possibilities.
Well, and because right about here in 1980 was when you started to have personal computers being more widespread. So it was no longer just mainframes.
You had
the Apple II. You had the TRS-80,
the VIC-20.
And so you could have people who didn't have access to a mainframe still having in their downtime a computer around to play around on. And that's where a lot of these things got started.
So they were part of the big wave of computers. And I think they got in right at the right time to really be successful and make a mark. So their next game was less inventive than Galactic Empire, and that was Apple Panic, which was an Apple-based, Apple II-based ripoff of Space Panic, which was a game by Universal that basically took, Hey Ankyo Alien, and turned it into a side-scroller. And you can really see the roots here for Lode Runner, honestly.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's different because the trapping works a little differently, but you drill holes and trap people in them, and you can fall through the holes. And
You have a shovel, I think.
Yes.
Kind of. Yeah.
But it's very similar in spirit to Lode Runner, but it's more of a point mission. I think you're trying to get rid of all the robots or something.
Yeah. It's more condensed. It's just the single mechanic is trying to get the things into the holes.
Apple Panic was one of the first Apple II games I ever played when I got my Apple II back in 90. And I have about 5 copies of it because it was very commonly pirated. I was surprised later on I was surprised at the time. I was like, man, this is just like Lode Runner because I had already played that on the Atari. Mm-hmm. So anyway, precursor.
That's awesome. All right. So their first big... I would say really innovative and really successful game came in 1982 with Choplifter, which again, we've talked about on the Sega episode. But it's worth mentioning again, just because it does take a different approach to the shoot 'em up. It's not a game about destroying everyone. It's really far more focused on search and rescue. Yeah. And you get points for blowing up enemy ships. But what you're really trying to do is rescue hostages.
Actually, don't even.
Oh, don't you?
No, in the original game, it does not keep track of any. The only thing it keeps track of is the hostages.
Okay. Maybe I'm thinking of some of the later ones.
Some of the other ports might. Yeah. But the original game, I mean, that was a specific thing the guy did is he didn't. So this was an early example, again, of them picking up just, someone with a good idea and shepherding it to conclusion.
The someone in this case was Dan Gorlin?
Yeah. I didn't have his name here. But Dan Gorlin. So he had... He was in, another one of these guys who had just been messing around with computers in his spare time, and he had made this helicopter animation, was seeing what he could do with it. And he's like, yeah, I could do a shooter, but there's lots of shooters out there, so we should do something else. And that's about when Brüderbund brought him on and started working on this concept of, the main thing is going to be, this is a story about rescuing the hostages. And so it made it into, again, this is their theme, sort of doing a different twist on things.
It occurs to me. That, the Vietnam War loomed heavily in everyone's minds at the time, even though it wasn't going on or anything, but there were lots of veterans around.
I mean, and so much of early 80s media is a response to the Vietnam War the fallout. G.I. Joe was all Vietnam vets. Rambo, First Blood.
Yeah, Rambo.
There was so much of that in the media.
Yeah, so I think, Choplifter may have been inspired by that. Those meta chopper, whatever the term is for it, they would come in and get the people who are injured out of the battlefield. And that was a Vietnam innovation, as far as I know.
I thought that was Korean War, because there sure was a lot of that in
maybe
MASH.
There was.
Incoming enemy wounded.
Yeah.
Attention all personnel.
Helicopters?
Yeah.
They had the little
beds on the side. But still, I see what you're saying. They had mobile bases that they would take rescue choppers.
In my own mashed up version of the Vietnam War in my head from what I've seen on TV, they always show those medical guys coming in with their helicopter and picking up.
Absolutely. I'm not at all saying
so
like there was no specter of Vietnam looming over this game. There probably was. And, the fact that it was very much like a game centered on rescuing people as opposed to gunning down the enemy really gave it a different personality. And I think a more meaningful tone.
Yeah, it's striking how different it is from, even though you're in a flying thing and you're shooting at things, it's striking how different it is from other shooters of the time. And like, you're surprisingly, I think partly because this started out as a demo of trying to realistically animate a helicopter, you're surprisingly maneuverable and you can aim at things on the ground and at things in the sky, even though you're just a side scroller. You're not like fixed into one direction.
The way it kind of imitates the dynamics of a helicopter is really interesting because
it rotates, but it's
also like you can aim up and down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it really does kind of capture the weird, unique movement of a helicopter versus an airplane or a spaceship. Like, how does a spaceship even move?
They
just go in circles around the planet.
What year was Defender?
Defender was 80, I think. 80
yeah,
or 81.
So this was supposed to, and yeah, and then there, it
Defender,
has,
you rescue
it has a
people,
lot of similarities.
Kind of.
Yeah, it has a lot of similarities in that you have this continuous horizontal plane that you're going back and forth on, and that you're rescuing people. But the mechanics of it really kind of mix it up in that you can, you can strafe the ground and you can aim
you
up.
Have
the,
to land.
And you have to,
yeah,
land.
Defend,
you have
Defender,
to, you have to actually land to let people on.
It's, Defender definitely has the element of rescuing people, but it's really not so much about like rescuing and retrieving people so much as just preventing the aliens from getting a hold of the people.
Yeah.
And there's no base to take them back to. That's what makes, I think, Choplifter so interesting is that you do have a base that you're trying to return to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that adds a lot of challenge.
And you have a capacity in the helicopter, so you can only fill it up so much.
Right.
You have to go back and offload. Yeah.
And also the people are very vulnerable. You can't just like land on top of them because you will squish them. That's bad. You don't want to do that. You have to land next to them. So then as they run over to you, you're vulnerable to enemy aerial attack.
Yeah. So then, you have enemies approach. You have to take off again and take care of them and then land again carefully to let more people on.
It's a game that really puts you at a disadvantage. And in the way that, like something like Pac-Man does, you still have a gun, but to play the game properly, you really have to put yourself out there and make yourself vulnerable. And to really maximize your score, you have to get as many people into the helicopter at once as you can. And if you get shot down, then that's really bad because you lose the opportunity to rescue all those people. They all die with your helicopter.
Yikes.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, a great game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was one of their real successes. Like this ended up in a lot of places. Ended up getting ported to everywhere.
Like a breakthrough game for them, probably.
So 1983, one of their big games was Serpentine, which I thought was going to be, like, when I first saw a mention of it, was going to be like, Snake. But it's like Snake meets Pac-Man.
Snake and Pac-Man, yeah.
It's really interesting. And you're not trying to trap the other snakes. You're trying to eat them from behind.
Yeah, I love this game.
It's like the competitive Ouroboros game.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a maze-based game that plays off the popularity of Pac-Man. So there are dozens of games that were variations on maze games after Pac-Man, especially on home computers. But this game, you are a sort of snake caterpillar kind of thing with body segments, and you have to, there are enemy ones of different lengths, and you have to sneak up from behind them and chomp up their bits, and you grow longer over time, and you can't let them get you from behind, or you can't run into them, and there's frogs that come into it, they hop in and change things.
There was something about, so I never came across this back in the day, but I was watching a playthrough and there's something about laying eggs, seems like. And then does that give you extra lives? I couldn't tell quite what was going on.
I swear, the funny thing is I've played this so many times, including I play this every year when I get out my Atari 800 at Christmas. And there's just you're just the body segment dynamics is the main part of the game where you're getting longer and shorter. And if you're longer than the enemies, you can eat them head on, I think, if you're longer than them.
I saw someone eat someone else
and
head on.
If you get a frog, like, you grow longer. I think that's the way it is.
Yeah, that definitely happened.
Because there's another game I play all the time, and it's one of my favorite games too, but I completely forgot what it's called on the Atari and Commodore and stuff and VIC-20. But it's another snake game where your body does grow longer as you eat it, kind of like a snake, and it's in a maze too. But there are no enemies. You just have to avoid hitting your own tail. Mm. I love that game.
It seemed like there were some interesting trade-offs at play in the sense, you want to get longer in order to.
The longer you are, the more dangerous you are to them, but you're also at greater risk because it's easier for them to grab your tail.
Right, for them to run into you. Mm-hmm. And there's this egg-laying thing that seemed like maybe was a trade-off where you sacrifice some length to maybe get an extra life at the end of a stage or something.
I don't remember that for some reason.
But
it's the gin, man. Know. I just can't remember.
Should have waited. All right. Well, now that we're drunk.
I need three more.
actually, 1983 was a big year for Bruderbund. 1983, they also published Star Wars, which was a really good-looking PC conversion of the Atari game. Like, I didn't realize this conversion existed, but I saw footage of it on YouTube when I was doing research, and I was like, that must be, like, some sort of fan game from later. But no, it is Star Wars. It is a damn good conversion of the vector game to, you know, the limitations of a personal computer.
You know, somebody uploaded this to my BBS as a piece of wares, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was a pirated game at the time, but because it was really old in the early 90s. Mm. And it just said Star Wars, and I played it, and I was like, man, this is exactly like the arcade game. It's incredible. It looks like a vector thing, and it was mind.
I had a little trouble finding the exact, like, the full provenance of this conversion. Mm-hmm. Some sources say they published it in 83. Some sources say it was 87, which maybe is more likely because the arcade game came out in 83. Yeah. So I could see, like, a few years later them putting together a great conversion. But in any case,
whoever did it was really talented.
It's a hell of a version.
Yeah.
I would have been blown away if I had seen that version of the game running in someone's home in the 80s, anytime in the 80s.
Yeah. That would have been amazing. Yep.
Okay, but they're big games in 83. First, there was Spelunker, Tim Smith's. Is that his name? No, Tim Martin, I think. Why did it say Tim Smith here? Huh. I think I wrote that down because I was, like, falling asleep or something. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure his name is Tim Martin. It's his Hateful Classic. It is a game that lives in infamy, especially in Japan. Like the other game we're going to talk about, Lode Runner, it was one of the early conversions to Famicom, a very hot, you know, international PC hit being converted contemporaneously to Famicom, right? As people were like, oh yes, let's buy a Famicom and let's buy, you know, the dozen games that are available for Famicom. Everyone had one. Irem brought it over and everyone hates it, but they love it because it's really cruel and hard. But because they were kids and they had like three games and they had to get their most out of their allowance, they played this game over and over again. So it has lived on in infamy. Whereas Americans are kind of like, oh yeah, Spelunker.
Yeah.
All anyone cares about Spelunker now in America is that it gave us Spelunky through inspiration.
Yep.
But in Japan, they love Spelunker. It is like you can buy merchandise all over the place. There's a company called Tozai. I think they picked up Spelunker and also Lode Runner and keep reissuing it. Square Enix just published last year, what is it called? Spelunker Party, which is like a four-person cooperative Spelunker. And it keeps all the limitations. Yeah. The idea is you're like a guy running around through cavernous mazes. Yeah. And if you fall from
2 inches.
Yeah, like 2 pixels higher than your actual height, then you will die. Mm. Yeah. And there's things coming at you all the time. You have to drop bombs and you get caught in your own bombs.
There's a Spelunker HD on the PS3 and some other platforms that's like that. It's just different graphics, but it's punishing. You'll where you can't fall off a vine or whatever, two inches or whatever.
And I love Spelunker because it takes the essence of that and makes it way more playable. And it also gives it that, you know, kind
Spelunky?
Of Spelunker. Spelunky, yes.
Yeah.
Spelunky. God. Yeah. Derek, you. You and your very close names to your Spelunky property that you're homaging.
I wanted to love Spelunker so much because it looked kind of like Pitfall, which I was familiar with. And I bought an NES copy, but I guess I'm fortunate that it didn't work. I bought a used copy, you know, in the early 90s, and it was broken, so I never played it on the NES.
You know, there's merit to the game. Like, we're talking about how hard it is, and it is hard, but... You know, it works according to very specific rules. So once you learn the rules and you learn your limitations, and boy, do you have limitations, then the game is, I assume it's beatable, but at least it's, you know, playable.
Mm-hmm. And it's got pretty just, nice looking environments for the time, you know, it's nicely rendered caverns.
There's lots of diverse enemies and hazards, like a ghost and a bat and just different things that kind of like appear where you don't expect them. But it takes a while to learn the game. And the first real encounter I ever had with Spelunker was at a Tokyo Game Show 6, 7, 8 years ago, when they were showing off Spelunker HD for PlayStation 3. And, you know, they have the demo station set up like at E3. And there's a nice lady there who will hand you the controller and try to explain how to play the game in Japanese. And I was like, nah, wakarimasen. And just started playing and like... went through my 3 lives in about 30 seconds, and there was this real look of pity in her eyes. She took the controller away and was like, arigato.
Walk of shame.
Yep, it was shameful. But the game's really hard.
I'm almost really intrigued by the sort of the back and forth in this era between the US and Japan, because we were just looking at one of Jeremy's eBay piles downstairs over the break, and he has a copy of Spelunker for NES, which says prominently on the front of the box, you know, like million seller in Japan as a selling
point. Sold half a million in
Half a million in Japan, yeah. So, you know, this was originally, like, I assume it was on Apple II and stuff. But, like, for selling it on Nintendo, you know, they didn't assume people knew about, like, the Apple II scene. They're talking about how this is big in Japan.
On the Famicom.
There's a lot in this era that like, had this weird, like, random things from the U.S. would, like, catch on big in Japan, and then we get them filtered back.
I think
back.
Maybe they didn't say, like, sold a million copies on Apple II, because then instead of buying it on NES, why don't you just go borrow it from your friend who has a copy on Apple II, or copy their disc?
Right.
So I think they wanted to kind of, like, say, like, that ecosystem doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Don't pay no attention to the personal computer behind the curtain.
Yeah, but I think it's also because what you were saying, like, there weren't a lot of options on Famicom yet at the time.
There are certain franchises that became computer franchises that became really big on Famicom just because of timing. Mm-hmm. And Lodrunner and Spelunker are two of the biggest beneficiaries of that timing.
Yeah.
And Lodrunner would become even bigger than Spelunker.
Right.
Like, Spelunker... It has that, like, Kusoge nostalgia. Like, people hate it. Uh-huh. They're like, this is the worst game. It's crap. I hate it. But I love it. Whereas Lodrunner, like, it was a genuine success. And they kept, like, iRim... Well, let's see. Hudson made the first few games. And then iRim made, like... I think they converted some of the sequels to Famicom Disk System and started making their own. Mm-hmm. And then Hudson got it back and they made like this crazy cubic version for GameCube.
Yeah. Like, it's always interesting to see these things filter back. You have things that started in America, but then like spent this time in Japan where they were huge. And then we get like the results back. Like, you know, you had Wizardry got huge and then it filters back through JRPGs.
Right.
And like, there's a whole bunch of this in that. Yeah. It's just fascinating.
Yeah. Lodrunner always like filtered back in its original form, but the NES version of the game was the one converted by Hudson, which Hudson said, hey, why don't we tie this to Bomberman?
Yeah.
So there's like a narrative link in that Lodrunner to Bomberman.
Yeah.
But there was the creator of Lodrunner died 3 or 4 years ago, Doug Smith. So I'm sad I never got to talk to him, because I would have loved to have interviewed him about this game.
Yeah.
But there was an interview with him on IGN back in the 90s, like 1998 or so, when there was some sort of Lodrunner game coming to like N64 or PlayStation. So they interviewed him, and he said, yeah, you know, this game was a big hit on Apple II, but that's nothing compared to its success in Japan. Like, it was a monster over there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, I can't even remember how to pronounce her name anymore, licensing this game to Hudson was, like, one of the smartest things they did, because Hudson, you know, a year after the PC game came out in America, brought to Famicom this system that was exploding over there in popularity. And so it just became, like... part of the DNA for gaming over there. And it tied back to Heianchio Alien. It has that same like trap 'em up element to it. Mm-hmm. Lodrunner, of course, is a side-scrolling platformer, although it's only side-scrolling on NES. On Apple II, you can see the whole maze at
single
once.
Level. Mm-hmm.
But your guy is very athletic. He can climb ladders. He can walk hand over hand across these bars that are hanging. Yeah. And your only ability is to drill holes in the ground. And so you can trap like the enemy robots or monks or whatever. And if the walls seal back over, the floor seals back over them, then they'll be destroyed and respawn someplace. And you're collecting gold from throughout the maze, and you can carry all the gold you can possibly get, but robots will also pick up gold. So if you collect all the piles of gold you can see, but you still can't leave the level, it's because one of the robots has it. So you have to figure out which one. You have to trap them. You have to cause them to drop their gold, and then you have to escape. And there's these all these strategic elements to it. Like there are platforms that you can drill through, but if it's more than one brick tall, you can't just drill down because you drill one step ahead of you. So you have to like drill kind of like a funnel. So you drill like, if it's three thick, then you drill like three ahead of you, then two on the next level down, and then you drop down again and you drill one and you can fall through that. Otherwise you trap yourself and the bricks will seal up over you. Yeah, so there's a lot of strategy to it.
It's one of the games that is of the type that, you know, you have this set of simple rules, but then the way they interact gives you a lot of emergent possibilities.
Good way to put it. Yeah, complexity from simplicity. Yeah.
And this is also there's even like more emergence to it because, as you mentioned,
right, there's a level editor. It's one of the first widely distributed games that came with its own level editor. And again, because you had these simple mechanics, but so many ways you can put them together. I think that was huge. Letting people make their own levels. I mean, the game as they published it came with a ton of levels, but then you can just keep adding on to it. And they came out with different versions later.
Championship Load Runner.
Yeah.
And I think Championship Load Runner is actually the game that we got on NES in the US.
Probably.
I think there was a Load Runner, and then Championship Load Runner was converted and brought over. But yeah, it was just huge. And I think the game sold really well on NES. Like, I remember seeing it in stores for years. And as I mentioned earlier, that was one of the first NES games I bought because I was like, I can finally own Load Runner. That's so exciting. And I realized after I bought it, like, oh, you know, games are bigger now. I have Super Mario Brothers. I have Metroid. So this is not that exciting, but I still just liked having it, you know, because it was nostalgia from when I was a little kid, like 3 years before, the old days.
Yeah, the Apple II one you played. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we played this on the Atari 800, and my brother was really good at it, and it amazed me how he could avoid those robots. And I always loved the gold bars, just something about human greed who loves gold bars.
You want like little piles of gold.
Yeah, there's little triangles of three gold bars in a pile or something.
Something that really fascinates me about Load Runner is that pretty much all the box art for every version of the game shows your little dude like shooting, but you don't have a gun. You have a drill to drill into the ground, but they always are like, no, you're a guy with robots and you got a gun, but you don't. That's the whole point of the game, is that you're extremely vulnerable. It's like the Pac-Man with no energizers.
Marketing departments could not conceive of a space dude in an arcade style game that didn't have a gun. So.
Yep.
Well, you want him to run around with a jackhammer instead?
Yes, absolutely.
Like Dig Dug.
I think so. It was good enough for Dig Dug. It should be good enough for the Load
Joe
Runner.
Joe Runner. The Load Runner.
Right. That was 83. 1984 was also a big year for Bruderbund because they discovered two legendary video game designers, basically. Like, it's crazy, but one company gave us both Jordan Mechner and Will Wright in the same year. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's crazy.
And again, these were both guys who were just, you know, working on stuff and submitting it to places. Mm-hmm. And Bruderbund was who saw them and picked it up.
Yeah, they were like, yeah, we want these games. Yeah. Both of them were not amazing all-time classics on their own, but they paved the way for some of the most influential games that would both appear about 5 years later, and would just be like, you know, they would change the industry. They would change the medium.
So what should we start with?
Why don't you talk about Karateka? Because I've played it on Game Boy, but you guys talk about it more.
Yeah, I had Karateka. So this is one of the things that was on the Apple II machines in my school back in the day. So we had, you know, it was one of the ones. It's a pure game. It's just a game. It's punching people. So there's not much educational about it.
Hand punching. But there's kicking.
Kicking, punching.
Don't forget
kicking.
The kicking part.
Yeah, no, it was a great system. But it was so it was the thing that we could play after we had finished our like edutainment stuff, whatever we were actually supposed to be doing at school. But it was great. So it's it's for the time, it has a pretty dang detailed one-on-one combat system with punching and kicking, and the like there's a lot of really precise timing to it. And it looks just really good because Mechner did, this is where Mechner started his trademark rotoscoped sprites, where he just, you know, took photographs of people doing stuff.
I think it's his brother he's photographed.
That was for Prince of Persia. I don't think in this one.
I thought he may have done it in this one too.
I think it wasn't as extensive. It wasn't nearly as extensive, but I thought, he at least used photo references for it.
Yeah, must have. But yeah, this really gets okay, I'll call him up. Yeah. This really gets into the beginning of Mechner's fascination with classic cinema too, because this is very much inspired by like Chanbara, you know, Japanese movies where you know, a lone martial artist goes into the enemy castle and has to fight through an endless succession of bad guys.
And like us people who grew up on consoles, like probably a lot of our listenership at Retronauts, think of things like Ninja Gaiden as being some of the groundbreaking, like, cinematic games.
And they were, for sure.
But this was really going in the same direction on Apple II, in that it had, you know, it starts out with, like, you know, Broderbund presents Jordan Mechner game, Karateka. It, like, has this set of titles. And then it goes into
the scene. It even does, like,
the
cutaways.
It does, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does swipes. It does, swipes. It steals all
like,
kinds
you'll be fighting, and all
film.
Of a sudden, you know, you beat a guy and walk through a door, and then
it does
there's a
wipes.
Transition,
and the
you
guy
see,
starts running at you.
You see the daimyo, or whoever he is, Akuma, I think is his name.
Yeah, yeah, there's
like,
this,
sending out his little minions after you. So you get to see each minion you're going to fight, because they come out, you know, under Akuma's command.
Yeah, and there's foreshadow. He has this bird on his shoulder the entire time. Every time there's a cinematic of him, he's in his big armor. He's got this bird perched on one of his shoulder pauldrons. And then, like, at the end of the game, he sends out the bird.
Yeah, the only version of this I've played is Tosei's conversion for Game Boy, which I could not finish. It's crazy hard. It gives you the ability to allocate skill points at the beginning to, like, speed, power, endurance. And I can't find a good balance that, like, you know, some enemies you need to be really fast to be able to attack them first, but some enemies you need, like, greater endurance to be able to hold up. So, yeah, it's really hard.
I mean, it is.
And I'll never see the end myself.
Even in the original, it's not an easy game. Like, there's a lot of, you know, it's a fairly simple system, but there's a lot of, like, very precise positioning and timing. You just, you have to get a feel for each enemy to be able to get past
it. I have a story about this, which is, this is Karateka is one of the first video games I ever played, probably on the Apple II, because my dad actually built an Apple IIe clone himself. He got a circuit board from somebody or made it and got all the parts and the schematic, and he actually built it from scratch. And this is when I was really little. And so we had Karateka on that, and it was just terrifying as a kid to see those guys with the horns running at you, and I would just start running the other way and you fall off a cliff. But the music is cool too. It goes dun, 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 it's baked into my memory.
And it has those great combat stances too. Like goes, you can exit combat and you can like bow to your enemy and so forth before you start
a
the
lot
fight
of really nice touches.
Well, let me tell you, I found this so hard when I was 3-4 years old, whenever this was.
I played it when I was like 40 and I was like, oh, it's killing me.
I set this up just a year or two ago in my garage with an Apple IIc, and I let my 4 or 5 year old play it at the time, and she just got she got farther than I've ever been in the whole game. Like, she beat the first 3 or 4.
Have you put her in like martial arts class? She might be a natural.
My other kid tried martial arts one time, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe
you
she
should
will
try her. Yeah,
yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah. But and I think it also matches with Broderbund's kind of philosophy of trying to find new things and push what you could do. In that they like to push. You know, at this point in the mid 80s, we still think about this being kind of the era of arcadey games, like games that are just like, here you are, shoot the things. And Broderbund really wanted to push into, you know, we can, even if it's going to be something very simple, we can present this as a story, as a narrative.
Well, there's definitely an arcade element to this game, but the way it's so meticulous and so fluid and cinematic. Like, that's something you would not have seen in the arcades. Like, I guess, you know, this did come out maybe a year after Dragon's Lair. So maybe there was some like thinking there, like, how can we create a Dragon's Lair sort of experience as you know, within the limitations of an actual PC without a Laserdisc.
Yeah.
And they want, and this does have kind of a little bit of that flair to it, but it's a different kind of game. It's much more fair. It's much less of a like, hey, guess what button you have to push now.
And it's not what Mechter started out doing. Like I read this in the Apple II book.
Breakout.
So this is more from that book, which you should all buy. But the first thing Mechner submitted was actually sort of an Asteroids clone, Death Balls, I think it was called. So sort of Asteroids by way of billiards, where
Death
you're just
Balls, really?
Or Death? Oh, what was Death it?
Balls. No, I like that name. It's
something
great.
Like that. I think I've got it slightly wrong. But it was sort of an Asteroids clone, but instead you're shooting these balls that bounce off the sides. And he submitted this, and Broder Brown looked at this and said, "It's fine, but it's just another arcade game. We want something different." And that's when he started going in this completely other direction, which...
It's really a completely different direction.
It's a completely different direction. And so basically we have Broderbund's management to thank for having Prince of Persia and things like that that were different from what we were getting at the time.
That's cool, because that's the purpose of all good editors, is they push you in a good direction and they guide your work, you know. And that's probably what their role was too, as publishers.
Yep. So the next game I want to talk about, the next really big one, is Raid on Bungling Bay by Will Wright. And I don't really get this game, honestly, but it's extremely important because basically as Will Wright was putting together this sort of action-y simulation shooter resource management game, he was building, you know, military bases and maps and cities and stuff, and realized, you know, what's actually fun about this is putting together the maps. And that sent his brain spiraling to create SimCity, which, you know, this was 1984 along with Karateka. And in 1989, Karateka gave us Prince of Persia. In 1989, Raid on Bungling Bay gave us SimCity.
Yeah,
and
it's
we've had a full episode on SimCity. Go check that episode out. It's great. Everyone loves that game. It's cool. But this is kind of like the rough draft for it, like the inception point.
It's really part of the same story where they're moving from something that was a very arcade paradigm into a whole new direction. So like the actual point of this game is you're in, you know, some gunship helicopter and you're supposed to like bomb the enemy bases to prevent some evil empire from taking control. But like Jeremy,
the bungling
empire. I'm really curious where Will Wright came up with that, but I don't know.
They just keep making mistakes. It's terrible.
Yeah. But then it sort of went in this direction of building the maps for these bases. And that was the, you know, obviously what Will Wright ended up latching onto. So it's sort of the same thing where you have this base of an arcadey experience and like, what now can we do with that? What other directions can we go in?
Now, it should be said that Broderbund did not publish SimCity. They did publish Prince of Persia, like Mechner stayed with them. Mm-hmm. They even published his last game that they collaborated on, The Last Express, in 1997. Mm-hmm. So they had a long and fruitful relationship. Will Wright went off and formed his own company, Maxis, that hooked up with EA. It's cool that Mechner ended up, you know, maintaining his relationship with Broderbund. It's really cool to see that kind of, I guess, loyalty, like between not just, you know, from individual to corporation, but also corporation to individual.
A partnership.
I feel like they really gave him the liberty to do what he wanted. Let's talk about Prince of Persia and The Last Express, because those are both, like, we're going to go out of sequence here. But Prince of Persia takes the ideas of Karateka and really just runs with them and gives you a much bigger world to play through instead of just being like, walk forward, punch guys, walk forward some more, punch more guys. Now you're at the boss. It's, you know, like a dozen levels, 20 levels. You have an hour to get through it. It's full of non-human traps and hazards. There's like skeletons to fight. And you actually have, you know, a sword this time. You pick up a sword early on and you can, you know, do fencing. And it's very inspired by like Errol Flynn type silent movies, you know, very swashbuckling and dashing. But there's pits to avoid full of spikes. There are guillotine doors that'll try to kill you.
Fall away platforms.
Yep. Yeah. Lots of traps and tricks and hazards. And every time you die, I think you don't really like lose anything except the time that you've wasted. So, you know, you have an hour to make it from the deepest depths of the dungeon up to the Grand Vizier Jafar's tower or whatever, where you fight him and prevent him from marrying the princess and becoming the king of Persia, I guess.
Wow. It also brought us that cliff jumping thing where you hang on to the edge.
Grabbing the ledge.
Yeah, pulling yourself up.
Yep, that is like a video game standard now. Metroid started doing it and Tomb Raider started doing
it. Isn't that in Mario something? One of those
Mario does that now, yes. Yeah, he can shimmy along Assassin's Creed. I mean, Assassin's Creed emerged directly from Prince of Persia. The Patrice Desilets and some of the other people who worked on Sands of Time with Jordan Mechner went on to... Yeah. create Assassin's Creed, which kind of started out as an Assassin's Creed or as a Prince of Persia thing and went its own direction.
Yeah, this is another through line from the few good things that happened from Broderbund's takeover and acquisition. Yeah. Is this through line of Prince of Persia into Ubisoft and informing
Assassin's Creed has its ups and downs, but I think on the balance, it's been a good thing that it exists. And sometimes, like especially some of the Ezio games, you can really see the Prince of Persia in it. Assassin's Creed 2 especially, I think it was. There were like these churches and stuff that you could go into, these standalone dungeons, and you were like, really like, oh, I get it. This is Prince of Persia right here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you the first time I saw Prince of Persia, I have a vivid memory of this. We went into North Hills Mall, which was just a little simple building at the time, which is in Raleigh. And there's a computer store on the right after you exited JCPenney, and in the window on a monitor, they had a demo of Prince of Persia running. And it just blew my mind how fluid the animations were. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a showcase game for the IBM PC at the time. It really was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of those games that they would just put out on the computers at the store because you looked at it like that and Shadow of the Beast, and you were like, I need to play this. I need to own this computer. Yeah. And Shadow of the Beast, I don't think, held up that well once you actually played it. Yeah. But Prince of Persia really did. There was a lot to it. And it really... Yeah, like it's just a super influential game.
Computer stores also had full color pictures of parrots at the time. Yes. Always on display to show the color cards.
Look what you can do on Amiga. You can scan a photo of a parrot. Yeah. And let's see.
But Prince of Persia, I found very punishingly difficult, and I never got into it.
It's tough. You know, I agree.
Just I don't like it that much.
I feel like it's a very skill-based game.
It's for a certain type of person. Probably meticulous platformer, you could call it. You know?
Yeah, I don't think I ever actually beat the original
platformer.
You will perish. And then finally, The Last Express, the third game that Mechner created with Broderbund, is a very different kind of game. It's not an action game at all. It's an adventure game, but it just drills down on his love of movies. And it feels like, it's like if Murder on the Orient Express were a silent movie illustrated by Alphonse Mucha, was that his name?
Mucha.
The French artist. Huh. It's everything is basically like somewhere between traced and rotoscoped. It's very choppy animation now, but at the time it was kind of crazy.
Breakthrough kind of revolutionary stuff.
The only problem was that it came out in 1997 and everyone was moving to 3D. So having this really glorious 2D animation was kind of like, okay, that's fine, but you know, I could play Quake instead. So I think it never really found that big an audience, and it's been revived and republished a few times. But unlike, you know, Prince of Persia or Karateka, even, which had a really great 3D game that came out for Xbox Live 5 or 6 years ago, I feel like The Last Express has never really found. It's never really found purchase the way that it should.
Yeah. It feels like a niche kind of game.
It is very much.
I've never really run into it. Like,
I mean, at the time, adventure games were dying anyway. Hand-drawn animation was dying. Yeah. So it's like the worst possible timing to create a game like this.
Like, it ends up looking... So he took these rotoscope stuff and put this very like flat-shaded drawing over it. It ends up looking kind of... It reminds me of like European art cartoons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's very much that sort of... Art Deco Mucha style.
Yeah, yeah.
It also kind of reminds me of that traced movie that Keanu Reeves did like 6 or 7 years ago. And I can't remember what that was
called. Scanner Darkly?
Was it Scanner Darkly? Okay. Like it feels like the precursor to that in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really cool and interesting game. It's a very good adventure game. It's like time-based. You know, everyone on the train has their own routines and patterns. You saw ideas like that being explored in Majora's Mask and Shenmue a few years later, but it was really kind of a bold idea. It's you know, ultimately a pretty short story, so it's meant to be replayed and experimented with and tested and you know, for people to really dig into it.
Yeah. I'll tell you, at the time I had a huge prejudice against pre-rendered action sequences and full motion video, even if it was animated. Because of the whole full motion video debacle with the Sega CD and the 3DO and the CDI that just produced terrible games that weren't really interactive. So there was a prejudice already against something like this, I think, at the time, even if The Last Express is really great adventure game. You know,
no, absolutely. It was, you know, it was the wrong game at the wrong time. And it, even though, you know, irrespective of its actual merits, it just like it was a huge flop. And you know, Jordan Mechner wasn't the only person to flop with an adventure game at that point. You also had like Starship Titanic, which had Douglas Adams behind it, and LucasArts was having trouble finding purchase with their games. Sierra was, you know, having Old Man Murray articles written about how crappy they were. So it was just it was a rough time.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an unfortunate footnote. And I don't know, maybe, you know, whatever happened with The Last Express made it easier for the Learning Company to swoop in and grab Ruderbund up. Maybe that was a big loss for them.
Weakness, financial weakness.
Yep. So let's see. Two other big games worth talking about for Ruderbund is 1986. Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Yep.
The classic edutainment game that really turns learning into a grand world, you know, globe-trotting adventure. It's a great game.
So apparently this wasn't originally supposed to be an edutainment game. When it was developed, like early on, it was just like the idea was a cops versus robbers adventure game. Like, so point and click adventure, trying to take again like the early concepts from the early text-based adventures and make it more intuitive, make it with menus. I mean, that was what the guy who came in, again, you know, another guy with ideas that they picked up, and his idea was like, let's take adventure games and make it easy to use menus, so you don't have to like try to type the right verb or whatever. And so they were just going to do a cops and robbers adventure game, and someone had the idea to make it like world traveling and have the clues be about locations, and then it developed into what it is. What we all know as Carmen Sandiego. But even so, like, it was originally developed and marketed as just an adventure game. But then schools loved it. And apparently this actually, again, this is, I believe, from the Apple II book. But schools loved it, and it kind of took Ruderbund by surprise that all the schools were buying this, and it sort of went in that edutainment direction. I actually almost wonder, because this was 86, and some of the like more educational applications we talked about were shortly after this.
Oh, yeah.
This may be what really...
It started in like the 90s.
Cued, in like late 80s, early 90s. And so this may have been what cued Ruderbund into kind of that market being a thing to go for, the things you could get in classrooms.
Yeah, quite possibly so, yeah.
Yeah, but this property was huge. Like, it transcended it was video games. Yeah. There was a Carmen Sandiego cartoon.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a TV show. Yep. A game show on PBS.
Oh, I didn't know about
Where
that.
Oh, yeah. There was a live game show.
I didn't.
You're there was old. A live game show, yeah.
When I was in fourth or like fifth TV grade. Yeah, well, in fourth or fifth grade that came out, and it was a game show with kids who would try to track down Carmen Sandiego. It was on PBS.
It's really awesome.
It was neat.
Yeah, and there were lots of variants made, like Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego, and then there was the, I think, the North Dakota variant that Frank Spaldy dug up.
Frank had it there, yeah.
There was like a weird story there that I can't possibly hope to tell correctly, but yeah, there was like a very specific state-focused Carmen Sandiego in North Dakota of all places.
I
love that existed.
All kinds of spinoffs.
The other big game that Ruderbund published was Myst, which we've had like a full episode on, so we don't need to rehash that. But it did represent like a huge step for them. I think Gary Carlston in Breakout said like up until Myst, like the biggest thing they had was the print shop, and then Myst eclipsed that. Like, print shop was probably more profitable in terms of ratio, like cost to, you know, develop. Mm-hmm. But Myst was just huge.
It was everywhere. The top seller of the time.
It replaced Prince of Persia as the screen they put in the windows of the shops.
Yeah, I mean, it was very much like It was, you know, kind of like the Dark Side of the Moon was for a hi-fi system. Like, you buy this with your CD-ROM system to show off your multimedia setup. Like, you've got your speakers, you've got your 2X CD-ROM, and you've got Myst. And that's what I did.
Please go listen to the Myst episode.
Yes. but there were some other games that they published in their Shovelpuck Cafe, which we talked about in the Mac episode.
Which is great.
Bloodia Diablo, which is something I covered in Game Boy Works. It's like a pipe dream kind of game. It actually started out as a TI-99 foray game made for a competition by a guy named Manuel Constantinidis.
I looked at your video of that and it looked incredibly frustrating.
It's super frustrating.
Pipe dream being played on a 12-tile puzzle.
Yeah. Like, it's really tough. Like the Game Boy version is really tough because of the design. I think other versions of it probably hold up better.
Okay.
Probably Bruderman's version holds up better. They made a football game called Playmaker Football. Don't care about sports, so I don't know anything about that. Prince of Persia 2, The Fire and the Shadow and the Flame, I think is what it's called, was like more Prince of Persia, but better, and had even nicer graphics.
Yeah.
So great stuff there. So that was their computer library. Let's briefly touch on their console library and then wrap this thing up.
So we had some ports.
Yeah, we've actually talked about a lot of these.
Yeah.
Choplifter. Sega collaborated with them to publish Choplifter on a lot of different platforms. And yeah, now that I think about it, Choplifter never showed up on a Nintendo platform, although there was Choplifter 3 as a Super NES exclusive from, I think, like Kemco? So I don't know how that worked out. Loadrunner and Radon Bungling Bay, of course, were huge hits on Famicom and probably did okay for themselves on NES in America when they were released a few years later. 1987 also saw Deadly Towers, which have we talked about that on Retronauts? I know we've mentioned it, but have we talked about
it? Actually talked about it? I don't know. I've talked about it about five times now or so. Six times.
At least.
But you've mentioned it. Have you explained what it is?
I think we did a little bit. I don't know. You're looking for bells, demon bells or whatever, and you're going on towers. And you're
It's a shame it's a shame they didn't keep the original localized name for it.
Yeah. What was it?
It was going to be Hell's Bells.
Hell's Bells, yeah.
Because the Japanese title is Masho, which means like evil bells.
Yeah.
So Hell's Bells is a great localization, but Nintendo was like, no.
Yeah, Deadly Towers is cool because it was one of those things where we had it for the NES. It was one of our 5 to 10 games we had at the time, so we loved it just by default because we had to play it and there weren't any other options. And it had a lot of mystery and adventure in terms of the design of the world that you go through with all these towers. And I've also mentioned many times about there's something about the way it portrayed these towers with these windows that were black inside. And I always wondered as a kid does, what was behind those windows? Like what was inside those buildings? That's something an adult would never think, but a kid thinks like that. And it fascinated me. And it's a lot kind of like an action RPG, sort of like Zelda a little bit, but you do power up over time. You get new equipment. There are these mazes you go through, and then you have to fight bosses. And
you don't have very much confidence in your default sword.
Yeah, it's really hard at first because it takes like 20 hits to kill one of the first guys on the screen, which is why I think it has such a bad reputation. But if you power up for a while, you can do pretty well in it.
Yep.
Obviously, Rotorbun published it. Do you know who developed it?
Yeah, it was published in Japan by IREM, which means it's one of those Famicom carts with the red LEDs in it when you plug it into your system. But the developer was Lenar, who went on to develop Mercenary Force, a very cool game for Game Boy that I covered in Game Boy Works. It's like a multi-character shooter set in medieval Japan. It's a strange little company that made very unique stuff.
Huh, interesting.
It never occurred to me as a kid that this was Japanese because, of course, the cover art is a Western-style fantasy painting.
Right.
But when you actually play the game, you look like a little kid in booties running around, you know. attack. But that's like the super deformed Japanese style, I guess.
You're like a little scowling kid.
Yeah. We didn't know what that meant in America.
I mean, half the Nintendo library had that dichotomy at the time of the Western fantasy
There were many ports that changed that art style into a Western proportion character, you know, but they didn't do that for this one. And I think it got a lot of hate from Americans because of that weird art style, too. But I didn't mind it that much.
Yeah, I never minded the art style, but it was very, it was a little flaky on like the hit detection and that sort of thing. In the way of many early NES games.
Mm-hmm. There was an article on the, you know, the early internet of games and stuff, you know, before there was 1UP and all this game journalism online, Sean Baby had a huge footprint on the web, and he had a list of the worst
The games that he declared as terrible are still like in the internet consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so and Deadly Towers was up in the top.
Yep.
And that's in my post on Vintage Computing that was really popular in 2005 was a reaction to that Sean Baby thing where I said, no, actually Deadly Towers is really cool. And my friend mapped the whole thing out for the first time ever. Here it is on the internet. Bam. And it was fun. So
nice.
Moving on to 1989, there were three games that Bruderbund published for NES, and they're all great. I love all of them. The Guardian Legend, which is like, a shooty sci-fi Zelda with a bikini robot who is also a spaceship.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, how do you top that? No, it's a great game because it's set in a maze, like this planet that's hurtling toward Earth, I think, and going to destroy it. And so you go into the maze and infiltrate. And so the maze section is like top down, kind of like the top down sections of Blaster Master, but more Zelda-ish in terms of interconnectedness. Mm-hmm. But as you unlock the game and like travel through different regions, then you go to these corridors where the heroine turns into a spaceship and shoots enemies.
Yeah.
And so you have to complete these shooter segments on the corridors in order to advance in the maze sections. It's a really, really cool game. And it's a sequel to a Japan-only game that's just a shooter. They added the action RPG element to it.
This has to be Compile, right?
Yes. Because
it's got their little mascot guy as one of the bonus powers.
Randar. Yep.
Yeah. And this is actually one of the games that has been on my I really need to play it all the way through this list for like 20 years. I really
it's
need
a
to
really
get around
cool game.
To it.
The first time I played the Guardian Legend, I was really surprised at the depth of it and how I thought it was just going to be a shooter or something, you know, but it has all this extra dimension to it.
Yeah, I love it. It's a great game. It's very unique.
I need to get a hold of it somewhere.
Next on their list is Legacy of the Wizard, which I would describe as the graduate coursework in map drawing. Yeah. It is a massive, 16 by 16 map of screens. And it's basically divided into four sections. And you have a family that you control.
The Drazzle family.
It's the fourth Dragon Slayer game. So we've talked about it in the Dragon Slayer episode. And the Metroidvania episode. So I won't belabor the point. But they brought that over. That was Nihon Falcom, co-developed by Compile for NES, I believe. Great soundtrack by Yuzo Koshiro. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to like about the game. It's also completely, incredibly difficult and inscrutable, but I love it regardless.
It's this enormous, massive interconnected stuff. Then you need the right tools for wherever you are. And
And then
I love this game. I love it. We played it over and over and over again, and it's like one of those games where we had it, so we played it a lot, but I think it's a genuinely good game, even though it's so difficult, but I've never finished it or anything.
I finished it, but only by cheating and using a code.
Really?
So then finally, completing the Bruderbund NES action RPG trifecta is Battle of Olympus, which is a game that we all said, haha, that game is a total ripoff of Zelda 2. But a couple of years ago, I was able to speak to the director of the game, Yukio Horimoto, who currently is the head of the company that created it, Infinity. And it turns out, yes, it was designed very much to be like Zelda 2 because he wanted to make a popular, successful game. So he looked at Zelda 2 and said, let's make something like that. And so he and his wife and one other person, the composer for the game, sat down and created this entire Zelda 2 clone. And it's a damn good game for something
really
created by
impressive.
Three people.
It looks really good.
It looks good. It plays well. It has a great experience system. It has, it's all set in ancient Greece. I feel like we talked about this in Battle of the Metroidvania episode.
Yeah, Metroidvania we talked about.
But
twice,
it's just,
maybe.
Yeah.
I was here
so again, I don't want to belabor the point, but it's a really cool
game.
Ben,
do you have anything to say about it since you weren't on the Metroidvania?
Not a lot. It's another one I have never gotten the chance to like sit down and play all the way through. But yeah, like you look at it and you can see it's sort of like the reuse of assets and how they're making do with a fairly small amount of, you know, because it was only three people, there's only so much they can do in terms of, you know, drawing new assets and stuff. But it's really impressive. Like the whole package ends up looking really nice.
And finally, at the sort of the tail end of Bruderman's licensing efforts for the NES, there was Dusty Diamond's All-Star Baseball, which, I don't know, I saw Crontendo cover it, and it didn't really connect with me. I'm not really that excited about 8-bit baseball games. Sports. Yeah.
It's a baseball game.
I like that. It seems game, okay. I think.
It's actually like, I think, like a softball series, isn't it? Like, it's you're playing as kids.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I have a positive memory of this title.
Yeah, it's All-Star Softball.
Yeah, I liked...
Oh, All-Star Softball.
Okay. I'm not a huge sports fan either, but I think it's a neat game.
And it looks like there's like unlockable kind of joke characters. Like you can be hitting your softball with like a witch with a broom or an ogre.
It is a very like, oh, this game was made in Japan kind of game.
Yeah, you can definitely, guys, because there's a classic like Oni is one of the unlockable like batters there. Like clearly.
All-Star Softball.
But yeah, that pretty much wraps up Bruderman's NES licensing. Like they stopped bringing over games from Japan at that point. And instead, you know, I think once Prince of Persia came out, they were like, let's just get this on everything. Yeah. Then let's get Prince of Persia 2 on everything.
And then they hit miss.
And then they hit miss. And they were like, let's just publish on PC. Forget this console crap. Yeah, and so, the company just kind of naturally gravitated away from console publishing, which is a shame because they really, I feel like they really had an eye for publishing, like picking up good games to bring over, games that were kind of niche, kind of complicated, but really interesting and fun and memorable.
It's a small set, but it's a really good set of NES games.
And there seems to be some sort of relationship that I've never been able to lock down. I don't know exactly what the details are, but they seem to have some sort of relationship in the 90s with Sunsoft, who did a lot of the work on like the console ports of Myst. There was some sort of collaboration going on with Sunsoft. There's a French journalist who has been making an effort to dig into the history of Sunsoft, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's done a great job of like digging up some information about Sunsoft's history, and you know, he has dug up a little bit of information about their relationship with Broderbund, the band of brothers, those guys. Yes. Yeah. So I will definitely make a mention of his name in the notes for this on retronauts.com. So be sure to check that out. But anyway, I think that's pretty much it for Broderbund.
Yeah. So then they got kind of wrapped up and parceled off, and some of their stuff lives on. Some of them with Ubisoft,
but the legacy lives on.
I mean, we've got the whole Prince of Persia line going that way.
There's that.
And Myst
Myst wrapped up. It's done. They did the fifth game and they're done. But
well, and then there was Assassin's the online Creed thing, which comes in and out of existence sometimes. But
there's Abduction now. Abduction.
It's a spiritual. That's the new Millers. Yeah.
But I mean, The Sims is still around. That came out of Raid on Bungling Bay. You know, Assassin's Creed came out of Prince of Persia
stuff. Yeah.
So even though, and you know, there's Calendar Creator. So what more could you need?
No, they gave a lot of really amazing people their start.
HD.
So Bruderbund ceased to exist basically 20 years ago. But you know, people still have fond memories of their games. They were great games. You know. Spelunker is still around. Spelunky came out of Spelunker. Load Runner is still around. Like these games, Choplifter probably is still around. I think there was a Choplifter game HD a few years ago. So like these things that they brought into the world, they helped, you know, kind of midwife into existence. Like they still exist.
You know what I want is a Serpentine remake HD. That would be cool.
You could probably dig up the license for that really cheap and do it yourself. Honestly. Okay. Sell off your computer collection, use that money, buy the lice, the rights to to Serpentine.
Serpentine. Okay.
Yeah, it would be a very different industry without all the stuff that they helped bring into it.
So I have to say thank you, Jeff Vlasic, for requesting this topic and for, of course, supporting us at Retronauts, the Retronauts Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. I enjoyed talking about Bruderbund and digging up their work.
David Craddock for providing everything
so much information and research to life.
Yeah.
Be sure to check out Breakout, available at fine bookstores near you, or at least at Amazon.com. It's a great hardcover book with a lot of awesome anecdotes about more than just Bruderbund, tons of companies, about the who kind of made their mark on Apple II. So yeah, great stuff. Everyone, this was a team effort. Thanks so much. So why don't you guys tell us where to find you?
All right. I'm Ben Elgin. You can find me on Twitter at Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N. That's just my personal Twitter. I also have a retro things blog at kirinsretrocloset.tumblr.com. Only one N in Kirin on there. I do post retro game stuff on there sometimes, but if you tune in right now, I hope you like Legos because that's what I just dug out of my parents' closet.
Lego is plural.
Yes.
So. Not Legos.
Lego, plural Lego, yes, but there's going to be
one Lego, two Lego.
A lot of 1980s and 90s Lego is about to go up on there, so if that's the kind of thing that gets you excited, tune into that blog.
And I'm Benj Edwards. As usual, you can find me on Twitter at Benj Edwards and also vintagecomputing.com, and I have a new podcast called The Culture of Tech, theCultureOfTech.com.
And finally, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, where I'm making bad dad jokes and posting occasional photos of hand-drawn video game maps. I don't know. It's weird. You can find Retronauts, of course, on all your favorite social media channels, such as Twitter, Facebook, and Venmo. Yes, send us money. No, actually, you can support us on Patreon, as I mentioned before, patreon.com/retronauts, to get early copies or early access to our episodes with higher bitrate and no ads. That's pretty cool. And otherwise you can just listen to us at retronauts.com or on Apple Podcasts or Podcast One Network or any place that you acquire audio to fill your ears with. And so that's what we do. We're filling your ears. We'll be back again next week with another full length podcast and some Friday or another with a micro podcast. It'll be great. Look forward to it. Thanks a lot, everyone. Thanks again, Jeff Lossick. And thank you, Bruderbund, for having a hard to pronounce game name and also great games.